The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network
on News Talk.
With subvariants dominating here amid another COVID wave, what does the profile of patients look like in our hospitals as numbers continue to climb? Are masks and boosters the answer? What is the latest advice? Also, as the HSE plans to close the emergency department at Navan Hospital, what will be put in its place? Plenty to discuss with the Chief Clinical Officer of the HSE, Colm Henry, who's with me in studio. Colm, good morning and welcome.
Thank you, Pat.
Now, can you bring us up to speed on the numbers? How many in hospital? How many in ICU?
Well, we didn't want to be having this discussion again, Pat,
sure.
Certainly not in the middle of summer and seeing such pressures in emergency departments that we normally associate with the middle of winter. But as you introduced there, this current surge largely driven by these subvariants, BA.4 and BA.5, which have, as we call it, a growth advantage over the previous variants, meaning they're more transmissible or they evade the immunity we had from natural infection from vaccination.
Now, before we get to the numbers, just clarify, is a variant, a subvariant of Omicron, if you've never been vaccinated, in other words, if you're virgin territory for the virus, do you get very sick with this one?
If you're not vaccinated, you've no protection against either infection, clearly, because and you've no protection against serious illness. Now, the tendency with this variant is it tends to reside in the upper respiratory tract. People notice a different type of illness. But to go back to your question, look at the profile of patients hospitalised today. If there are over 300 people in hospital today with COVID who are not vaccinated, they're totally disproportionately
never
represented.
Been vaccinated.
No, they're totally disproportionately represented.
And how many in hospital altogether?
Hospital altogether, 812 now. It's rising. If you look back to the end of May, it went to a low of 167 that last week of May. We see it's still gradually inclined, but the rate of incline upwards is not as sharp as it was during that surge in March.
But it's still a surge.
It is a surge, a slower upward surge. We're drawing some hope from the experience in Portugal, where this plateaued for 4 to 6 weeks and then began to fall. We're about week 3 or 4 into that.
Now, the remaining, if 300 are virgin territory for the virus, not vaccinated at all, what about the other 500? What's their vaccination status and booster status?
Well, of that 812, just over half are actually there sick with COVID. It's important to put some perspective to this. And even when you look at the ICU numbers, which haven't risen sharply, which is some assurance, there are 33, and they've been oscillating between 33 and 24 over the past few days. So they've risen, but not sharply. There is a lag time, but I think we're safer seeing now in a couple of weeks into this surge that it doesn't seem to be translating the same amount of ICU cases. But again, looking at those who didn't get the first booster, about over half of those who are in hospital testing positive for COVID haven't had their booster. Again, disproportionately represented in hospitalised cases.
So half the people are truly sick with COVID, and the other half are not. They're kind of coping well. But are they actually incidental, or are some of them in with COVID, but it's not too bad COVID, or are they in with appendicitis or with other things?
No, good point. What they're in, the over half are sick. When you say sick, they're in because they're sick with COVID and they've got COVID-related illness, and that's why they're in hospital. The others are testing positive for COVID because they may have been tested for some reason that they were close to or in contact with or so on. They're obviously sick because they're in hospital, but they're testing positive for COVID. But we have to apply the same infection prevention and control measures to stop that transmitting through to somebody who's not vaccinated or somebody who's on chemotherapy or somebody who's post-operative. So it's a highly disruptive virus within a hospital setting for that reason.
What test are they using at the moment? Because anecdotally, we've heard that because it takes time to generate antigens, which will show up in the antigen test, whereas the PCR will get the detection at the very beginning. But we're hearing that people are showing positive for antigens long after their symptoms have been and gone.
Well, for hospitalised cases, we're using PCR tests.
Okay.
And there's been no doubt about that. And we have ready PCR facilities in our hospital setting. We were expanding out that testing facility at the very beginning, but way back in 2020, which seems like decades ago. Not only did we do national labs, the NVRL and ENFR and all that, we expanded out the facility within acute settings because they need to know for clinical reasons, Pat. The clinicians have to make decisions. They need to make diagnoses.
Yep.
They need to have access, just like influenza or other viral titers, they need to know what disease they're dealing with. So they need it for diagnostic reasons.
So you've got to treat everybody who tests positive, irrespective of whether they're symptomatic or otherwise. You've got to treat them as potentially infectious to others. Therefore, correct, the protocols come in, which does inhibit the ability of the hospital to treat other people.
It does. If you imagine that we're trying to stop that virus funneling through to somebody who's not vaccinated or somebody who's immunosuppressed, because in a hospital is full of sick people, that's an obvious statement, and their people are vulnerable and frail and immunosuppressed there. And what we want to do is break that chain of transmission getting through to somebody who's either not vaccinated or immunosuppressed or both.
How many of your staff are out with COVID at the moment?
Nothing like the peak we saw way back in March. We're looking at about 600 healthcare workers testing positive for COVID in the week ending June 22nd. We kind of have a week lag in that. Community, about 200. Again, nothing like the figures we saw in March, but nevertheless, a rise we're seeing, but way short of what we saw in March.
Now, what about long COVID? I know there's an industrial issue at stake with the INMO and the government. It's not your particular area, but how many cases of long COVID are you seeing within your staff?
Numbers I can't put exactly, but we have put together a long COVID plan. We worked with experts last year. We've appointed some infectious disease consultants with a particular interest in this. And we have a model of care put through, not just for staff, but for people throughout the country, which goes through the whole spectrum of care from communication, awareness, self-management, GPs and specialist clinics in certain hubs for what we call post-acute COVID. And that's people who've been very seriously ill in hospital. They get, understandably, residual respiratory and maybe cardiac symptoms for which they need aftercare. And then this phenomenon called long COVID, which is a work in progress for the medical community internationally. We're gathering information.
I mean, it is real because we've spoken to people with it.
No doubt about it. No.
The true understanding of why it lingers in some people and not in others is the conundrum.
Yes, and there's a few strange features of it, Pat. One is that it doesn't seem to correlate with the severity of the increase of the original illness. There is some correlation with age, but we still see it in younger people who didn't apparently have a serious primary infection, so that it carries some features that you wouldn't expect to see. You'd expect that people with severe original illness would predictably get long COVID. It doesn't appear to be a very strong, there's a correlation, but not as strong as you think.
Now, we believe that it might be a seasonal virus, and that may not be the case.
I'd love to say it was a seasonal virus. Then we could act with that lovely predictability that we do influenza, where every March we start thinking which vaccine is the country going to buy into for next September, October rollout when influenza comes. We don't expect to see it in June, July, August.
Yeah.
This is not a seasonal virus in the way we understand seasonal viruses, because right now in the middle of June, record levels of ED presentations is contributed significantly, certainly by COVID-19. But this is a virus we see in all seasons, not just autumn and winter.
Now, the question of reinfection, it was believed at the beginning that with, you don't get the flu twice in one season and you only get the flu again when there's a variant that you don't have immune protection from. We are seeing people reinfected with Omicron.
Yes, we are. And people, everybody knows somebody, either as person or someone you know, experienced, who've been reinfected. And it is tough message to get across. But people who got the Delta last year in summer and autumn have little or no protection against infection from BA.4.5.
But the vaccination...
But the vaccination protects from serious illness. So it depends which way you look at it. If you think, well, why didn't the vaccine protect me from getting the infection? The fact is the mutations allow a degree of immune escape for these new variants. But there's good, solid evidence that vaccines do give you a lingering, longer-lasting protection against serious illness. So I will persist with that message that things would be much worse if we hadn't seen the extraordinary levels of uptake. 96% of the adult population, that is an extraordinary figure, Pat, for this country, 96% of the adult population have had primary vaccination. And even the booster that we all got, 76%, the second booster, which we aimed at the 65 and older and the immunosuppressed over 12, a bit more disappointing. It's stubbornly stuck at 51%.
And yet when people hear these kind of broadcasts, they should kind of just lift the phone or go online and make an appointment. It's very easy to do and there's plenty of capacity. What about the second booster, though, for others? I mean, there's talk of the over 50s getting a second booster. But more importantly, your people on the front line, there are people jumping through hoops trying to get the second booster. When will HSE staff be offered the second booster?
We will when it's advised by NIAC. I know but it's been persistent message since the beginning that
NIAC, I mean, you know it's needed. What is keeping NIAC? They have been a little bit sluggish. That's the kindest way to put it, at various stages of the vaccination program. And as soon as they gave the nod, I mean, the public responded in spades.
They did. I can't speak on behalf of NIAC. I do know some of the individuals involved, Karina Butler, people of enormous integrity who really want to do the right thing, people who appraise the evidence in real time. And yes, sometimes it seems people are frustrated at the pace of decision making. But I know from regular engagement with her that she is on this 7 days a week looking at the evidence and balancing up decisions and making independent decisions, independent of any pressures we face or the Department of Health face.
But are they waiting for the Omicron specific booster to come on stream? Is that it?
There are specific monovalent, bivalent vaccines being developed against 0.4 and 0.5. The companies have released some information based on their research. But as you recall from before, Pat, what happens then is the EMA undertakes what's called a rapid review of the evidence. We need that independent evidence in the EMA to validate what the claims companies make, because they often, and we found this before with other therapies or otherwise, is there's a gap between the initial claims on small studies and what the EMA's independent evidence shows.
What about vaccines which have a best before date? And, you know, there are supplies with GPs and supplies with pharmacies. I would hate to think of those just been thrown down the sink. Metaphorically, they don't go down the sink, I know, but they are thrown away.
Well, the first thing is we were looking at options of sharing those with the developing countries and this work.
No, but is there a case for just offering them to anyone who wants one?
Of course, but that would demand an extension of the expiry date. And I know there's discussions about that, but at the moment, our job is to give a licensed, approved, advised vaccine out within the limits of its expiry date. If there's any change to that advice given through NIAC or otherwise, we will do it. But we wait for that evidence and we wait for that advice first.
Now, what is your own advice to people? You've already mentioned boosters, if people qualify for the boosters, and you're waiting for NIAC for the green light for other cohorts. What about mask wearing? In what circumstances would you wear a mask these days?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of it about, Pat. There's no doubt about that. It's out there in the community. Looking at even though much fewer people get tested now, because since February the 28th, the indications for testing were narrowed down to specific at-risk cohorts. But there's a lot of it about, and we all know that at the moment. The single most important advice, I will repeat this again, and people should know this, is if they're symptomatic, isolate, because that's when you're maximally infectious to other people. This is the single most important message for people. Even more important, the vaccines.
Yeah, because I've heard of people, you know, they're not testing routinely now. They become symptomatic. They think it's hay fever. Mm-hmm. So they carry on. And then a couple of days later, they're testing because the suspicion it could be COVID. And 2 or 3 days after the first symptoms, they show positive on an antigen test. Because, as I say, it takes time for the antigens to be generated by the body. So what is the advice? If you've got coughs and sneezes, spread diseases, put on your mask.
Well, first, you brought up the issue of hay fever. I think most people with hay fever understand and appreciate the symptoms of hay fever, and they understand how it's different from being sick. Sure. Hay fever isn't a sickness, it's a form of allergy. So, but I would persist, I'll come to a mask in a second. It really is critically important. If you're sick and you're coughing or sneezing, that's the time you're maximally infectious. And let's not forget, why is this 0.4 and 0.5? They've displaced the other previous variants. They now comprise about 90% of cases. Why is that? They're more transmissible. Probably more transmissible, and that means they're much easier to get than even the previous variant. So if you're sick with 0.4, 0.5 and you're coughing and sneezing, you are spreading that virus, and I would ask anybody in those conditions, self-isolate until your symptoms are free.
Now, it's also possible that you've hay fever, but you've also got COVID. So which sneeze is which?
Well, people make their own judgment. As a sufferer of hay fever myself, I know the difference. I think most people know the difference in hay fever and being sick. Now, with regard
and also people who routinely get it tend to take things like Telfast and so on to keep the hay fever symptoms at bay.
Yes.
But they won't keep COVID symptoms at bay. That medication, one presumes.
Not at all. Now, with regard to masks, just a couple of things. First of all, masks are still mandatory in healthcare settings, and it's still advised that people wear them where they feel, either for their own protection or protecting other people in congested indoor settings, or whether you're living or sharing a small space with somebody who may be immunosuppressed. I know Dr. David Nambaro, the WHO advisor in COVID-19, against reintroduction of mandatory mask wearing. It's not just a question of as a matter of public policy, but also we're dealing with a variant that's much more transmissible than the previous variant. And the potential...
What you're trying to do is get people to think about what they're doing, where they're going, who they're with.
Yes.
And, you know, they don't want to get it, but they don't... Yes. If they have it, they don't want to give it to somebody else.
Well, the kind of measure, if you really... If you felt you wanted to obliterate or to significantly reduce all possible modes of transmission, when we're back in an open society again and engaging with each other and shopping and going to pubs and restaurants and so on, the kind of mask wearing that would be required to have an impact for a very transmissible virus would be just beyond imagination.
Okay, but if you're sitting in a bus, for example, that's crowded...
That's a risk space, and that's something you might want to consider doing. And I think most people... I see an increase in mask wearing on my travels and buses in recent days and on trains, more people wearing them because people are beginning to realise there are...
Yeah, and they're thinking about their holidays. They don't want their holidays destroyed or the wedding they're going to or whatever.
Or be stuck away on holidays.
Yeah, indeed. Yes. Won't be able to get on the plane. Yes. Now, and we'll be talking about trouble in airports later on in the programme. Visitors in hospitals, how many hospitals have now restricted?
Well, it's a number. I can't give you the exact number. Kerry, Beaumont, others have restricted visitors. Hospitals, as long before COVID ever came, we saw visitor restrictions because there was outbreaks of Clostridium difficile, other hospital-acquired infection, winter vomiting bug, and so on. So this is a practice of hospitals that reluctantly had to restrict visitors to protect patients and protect services long before COVID ever came. And in the same way, some hospitals with particularly high levels of COVID, such as Kerry in recent days, made an individual risk assessment to restrict visiting in order to allow the outbreaks within the hospital to calm down
And visitors presumably are supposed to wear masks when they go into hospitals.
Well, absolutely. Well, we ask, mask wearing is mandatory in healthcare settings, and that's something we introduced, and it did not escape the February 28th escape of other restrictions.
Now, the other topic, as well as COVID, we thought we'd by and large finished with it, but it'll go on for a while. There may be more variants. But Navan Hospital, the decision after a little bit of... politics intervening, the decision is definitively to go ahead with the scaling down of the emergency department in Navan and then allowing for more elective procedures. That's the theory.
Yes, what we're trying to do in Navan Hospital, the clinicians in Navan for many years have been concerned about the safety of the emergency department and the intensive care unit. To give your listeners an understanding of this, when a sign is up saying emergency department, people would reasonably assume that the emergency department can take all levels of complexity, all degrees of illness, and would have all the support services behind it to support you should you be critically ill, including intensive care. The intensive care unit in Navan is the smallest in the country, 50 ventilated patients a year, and the emergency department simply doesn't have the backup services that one would reasonably expect in 2022 to give the whole profile of care that you would need, including acute surgery, which no longer is in Navan. But we've done in other hospitals is transition towards a model of care where about 80-90% of those medically ill patients can still attend, but those who are critically ill or unstable are brought directly to another centre where all those services
are being done. And that would work really well if people had confidence, for example, in the HSE ambulance service. And then we hear stories regularly on the media about how I waited for 2.5 hours while my mother with a broken hip languished on the floor.
A critical part of this enabling, and we've learnt from previous reconfiguration, is the provision of advanced paramedics in the community and rapid response vehicles. So where there are other Model 2 hospitals, which successfully transitioned years ago from being an all-singing, all-dancing 24-7 emergency department to one with a medical assessment unit and a local injuries unit, which remain very busy and active. What happens is those patients who are critically ill or unstable in the community are seen by advanced paramedics and then transferred directly to the right hospital first time. That's what we want
to do. But those advanced paramedics, are we talking about like the cardio motorbike?
No, these are people in and out.
You know, that's someone that can get there really fast.
Yeah, rapid response vehicle is what it's called. It does what it says in the box, and we're ready to go with this when our plans eventually come to fruition, is that these advanced paramedics have the capability to get there quickly, to assess quickly, to resuscitate, to triage and make a decision to bring somebody directly to a hospital that has all the support.
So the hiccup, I mean, we had local politicians making all sorts of noises. Then we had the minister putting his oar in. Then we had the resignation of Paul Reid, connected or not. Many people will make up their own minds about this. And now we're going ahead. So last weekend, what was it all about?
Look, Minister acknowledges our concerns. Engaged with him has very clearly acknowledges these risks which come from national clinical leads, from clinical groups, from anaesthetists in Drogheda going back years. quite rightly, he engaged and has listened to also the concerns of local politicians, and we met with the local TDs ourselves, and has asked us for a number of assurances on what services will be put in place once that emergency department undergoes the transition to that model I describe.
Okay, so it is happening, but happening in a way that will assuage the fears of local people.
That's what you want to do. And I want to reassure anyone listening today that what this transition involves is the hospital will become expanded in terms of the services, daycare services, ambulatory services, elective surgery, endoscopy, but continue to see acutely ill patients, but not those who are unstable or critically ill who need to go somewhere else first.
What is the reaction, your own reaction, but also within the health service, of the departure of Paul Reid in December?
Obviously, very sorry to see him go. I had a good, very good working relationship with him. He provided great leadership, which he, during a crisis, he never expected to see when he came into post himself. So yes, it's certainly a difficult time. So many people leaving. Perhaps not surprising when one considers the pace of work people have had over the past few years.
Are you going yourself?
No, I'm staying on. I'm staying on.
Maybe there's a big job that beckons. Who knows?
I don't think so.
Some of the questions coming in: is there a significant difference in community transmission between vaccinated and unvaccinated people?
In terms of his ability to transmit, it's a good question. People who are vaccinated probably have a lower chance of catching the virus, and perhaps lower ongoing secondary transmission. And
if they're not sick, they may not be that symptomatic. Is that the idea?
Yeah, some studies in households before showing lower rates of secondary transmission in vaccinated people. So in theory, and based on some evidence before, at earlier stages of the pandemic, lower rates of ongoing transmission from those who are infected.
Someone else wants to know, an interesting scientific question: how many who've only had natural infection, which he says, Paul, is far superior, are reinfected and in hospital?
Natural infection.
In other words, they got COVID, they never got vaccinated. Are they likely to escape hospitalisation if they contract?
Well, all we can say is that it's very difficult. We can characterise those who are hospitalised in terms of vaccinated and unvaccinated. As I've given you the figures earlier, we don't characterise the total number of those cases identified from week to week as vaccinated and unvaccinated. But we do in the case of hospitalisations in ICU for obvious reasons.
In your discussion, re-masks, surely now is the time to have N95 or KN95 masks as the minimum masks to wear. These blue surgicals are just not cutting it with this variant. That's from Aidan.
I think certainly what we advise in health, where it remains mandatory, we're stating very clearly to our healthcare workers that those FFP2 masks are the preferred mask where there's direct patient contact.
Yeah, this is FFP2, yes. FFP3, KN95, N95.
Yes, so if you're in direct contact with known or suspected COVID, that remains the preferred mask. But as I said earlier, Pat, in our discussion about community mask wearing, there's a lot of scepticism whether mandatory community mask wearing will be effective.
Another one: we had COVID in March, we're over 65. Can we go ahead now and get our second booster? So in March, April,
yeah,
May,
months,
June.
Yeah? 4 months, go ahead.
Go ahead. How many ICU beds have been added to the healthcare system in the last year?
Yes, if you go back to pre-pandemic, we had far too little. We had 255. We're at about 305 now, and that's this is pandemic. By the end of the year, we hope to get about 321. And by we have a multi-annual plan, which involves a big capital bills that you just don't buy the bed and drop it in, go down to Bargain Town, buy a bed and drop it in. You have to build a unit. So the next phase going up to 446 will take a number of years for specific capital bills on some big sites in Dublin and Cork.
If you're pushing the vaccination programme, why are you also closing vaccination centres?
Well, we're restricting down the number of vaccination centres. We're looking now at a new model, a newer model, and maybe more sustainable model of vaccine provision from September onwards, when we were giving the flu vaccine and maybe an additional booster. And that will
so what would it be? Pharmacies and GPs?
Pharmacies and GPs. And that's the way we did business. And that's the way things were very effective. GPs knew their patients. Patients trusted their GPs, and it allowed us to use a tried and trusted method.
Another one: why are there only boosters for the over 65s? I have underlying conditions, but I can't get one.
Well, the advice of NIAC is over 65s and those who have immunosuppression from 12 years of age upwards.
So even if you had other conditions that make you quite ill, you don't qualify for a booster.
That person could be eligible.
Could be eligible. They need their GP to kind of certify their eligibility.
Contact their GP and ask for advice.
Today's the last day for Tony Holden.
Indeed it is, and I just want to acknowledge his huge leadership commitment, and certainly what I've witnessed courage in his time as CMO and the collaboration I had with him through some quite difficult times. And Pat, to be honest, this happened at a time of huge personal sacrifice for him and his family.
Sure. And the question people are wondering, you have the head of the HSE who's departing, as we know, in December, but you have the Chief Medical Officer. Sometimes a bit of confusion as to who's in charge.
Well, the HSE is the delivery arm of the organisation. The CMO is the Chief Government Advisor in Health and resides in the Department of Health. All this demanded a close collaboration. There were blurred lines at times, but I think in the overall scheme of things, we got more things right than wrong in the past few years.
Dr. Colm Henry, who's Chief Clinical Officer with the HSE. Colm, thank you very much. Always a pleasure having you in this studio, and thank you very much.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.